So the brave little flying toaster, Ingenuity. Bob Zimmerman, he keeps the website Behind the Black. Bob, Ingenuity has made its last flight. What do we know? Good evening to you.
Good evening. Well, yeah, Piers, my estimate, my speculations were wrong, at least on one point. I thought that most of their problems had to do with line-of-sight communications. That was probably a factor in this. But it appears during one of its last two flights, and we're not sure yet which, there was a problem that damaged one of the two propellers that Ingenuity used to fly. And so after its 70-second flight, which was up and down, on its way down, they lost contact with it. They finally met, but they had some line-of-sight communication, so they were able to download a few images. And the images they got shows the shadows of the propellers, and it indicates that one of those propellers is damaged. So NASA's announced they have retired Ingenuity. This is a mission that was only supposed to fly four times over 30 days and just prove that a helicopter could fly in Mars' thin atmosphere. It worked so well that it completed 72 flights. It flew for a total airtime of almost 2 hours, more than 2 hours. It flew more than about 11 miles cumulatively. It reached 22 miles an hour at its fastest flight, and its top altitude was 79 feet. On its 69th flight, it traveled almost a half mile. It definitely proved out this technology more successfully than anyone could have imagined. What will happen next, obviously, is Perseverance. It's near the spot where Perseverance is supposed to go, so there's no question that even if it's a little off that route, they're going to take Perseverance close to it to get really good pictures so they can try to and analyze exactly what went wrong for future helicopters. You need to know this stuff. Big success. We also should applaud the engineers who designed and operated Ingenuity for 3 years. They did a magnificent job.
Does Ingenuity have a camera?
Yes, it has two cameras, a color camera and a downward-looking black and white camera. And, once again, there are probably images in its computer memory that haven't been downloaded yet. We just have to wait for those to come.
And when that camera turns on and off, it can see Percy approaching, but... Does that camera work?
No, it can't. It can't, John. Those cameras generally look down. The only time Ingenuity can get a horizon picture in the past was if it tilted sideways slightly. Well, it's sitting on the ground, so its cameras will only look at the ground pretty much near it. So it won't get pictures of Perseverance coming close, but Perseverance will get pictures of it as it approaches.
Another engineering marvel is SLIM. What is SLIM and what's happened, Bob?
SLIM was a Japanese lunar lander that was testing the ability of an autonomous robot to land precisely in a very small target zone. And it landed on the moon last week, and it apparently landed successfully, but for some reason its solar panels were not getting power. It has only one solar panel on the side of the spacecraft. It's a test panel testing a flexible solar panel. This is an engineering mission almost entirely, testing new engineering. But if for some reason it was supposed to face to the east to get the morning sunlight on the moon, but it was facing west for some reason. As it landed, SLIM released two tiny mini rover test vehicles, very tiny. One was a ball that was supposed to roll across the surface, and the other was kind of like two hops. Well, they did manage during the little bit of time that they operated SLIM after the landing, before its batteries got low, they did manage to get data back from one of those two mini rovers, the ball-like one, and that included an image which tells us why the solar panel's on the wrong side. It's not facing east, it's facing west. The thing, SLIM, landed upside down. This is quite incredible. I've got a picture on Behind the Black. It was moving, it was really close to landing when one of the two descent engines had an issue and shut down. And so it was no longer firing its engines in a balanced manner. And it was very close to the surface at this time. So this unbalanced manner kind of turned it sideways. And so as it dropped those last few feet, it kind of like dropped upside down, landed on its top. And that's what the picture shows. But it didn't get damaged in any significant way, and they were able to communicate with it. And the only problem was the solar panels are facing west, where the sun hasn't reached yet, instead of facing east in the morning light. Now, hoping when the sun comes around, the solar panel will get some light as the sun is setting, and they will be able to get this thing activated again. It has been a success. It proved its ability to land within a very small target range. It proved it could operate after it landed. Its other engineering tests have mostly worked. It proved you could land on the moon upside down if necessary. This is an incredible thing, John.
And is the expectation that every time the sun hits it, it will be a functioning moon?
No. Once this thing was never expected to last and survive through the lunar night, the two-week-long lunar night. It's a very harsh environment. The main thing was to test landing and to do some research during that first two-week period, similar to what India's Pragyan lander did. And even what China has generally expected from its landers, they didn't expect them to last through the night. China's had great success making it last longer. This was never expected to last more than. So once the sun set, we can pretty much expect Slim to have mission to be over.
The moon's south pole. Bob, you have an image of the moon's south pole. What are we learning?
Some scientists went back to the Apollo-era seismic data. Most of the Apollo landings put a seismometer on the surface. And so they could. So scientists in the 70s could actually detect lunar earthquakes and map out the inner core of the moon. So these scientists went back to that archival data to analyze what kind of quakes were occurring at the south pole of the moon, where NASA and many other countries are aiming to land, because the hope there's maybe ice in those permanently shadowed craters. And so these scientists published a map, and I posted this map on Behind the Black, showing areas where earthquakes could easily disturb boulders and rocks and cause avalanches on slopes. And many of those active areas are inside landing zones that NASA is considering for the Artemis manned landing. No landing is going to actually put down on one of these spots. Well, I shouldn't say that. One or two may, if they go there. But this is information to tell us, you know, maybe you shouldn't go to one or two of those landing spots. The scientists in the space themselves conclude that in the South Pole region, we conclude that such an event, an earthquake, an avalanche, poses a potential hazard to future robotic and human exploration in the region. It's potential. It's also this survey, this report actually helps avoid that problem because it tells you where not to go. It is interesting that the slopes of Shackleton Crater at the South Pole, which is one of the prime places everyone wants to go, that's extremely unstable. They really think that avalanches down the sides of the interior slopes of Shackleton are not infrequent. In fact, could happen quite often. That would make you getting to Shackleton for permanent ice, less optimistic, John.
I've never heard this, Bob. Is this new thinking about the seismic activity?
It's a different approach to the seismic activity. When they did the seismometers back in the 70s, the main goal of scientists then was to analyze and figure out what the interior of the moon was like. Did it have a solid core? It does. And how active it has been. Is it any liquid on the inside? It apparently does not have any liquid in the inside. That was the main goal. What these guys did is they looked at the seismic data, specifically what it would tell them about the south pole of the moon, a localized area, because that's where we want to land. And that was a different approach, and it produced some good results.
A prediction of a very small asteroid, not likely to cause trouble in Paris, 3 feet. But what have they predicted, Bob?
This is the eighth time this has been done. Amateurs looking for asteroids that might hit the Earth, and JPL combined their efforts to identify a newly discovered asteroid, only about 3 feet in diameter, so it's no threat, it'll burn up in the atmosphere. They identified it only hours before it was going to impact the atmosphere, only 3 hours before. And using the technology from JPL and the data from the amateurs, they were able to predict where on Earth it was going to burn up, above Germany. And from that data, many, many astronomers and amateurs even, just ordinary people with smartphones, were able to take images of this asteroid as it burned up above Germany, producing a fireball. It's only the eighth time this has been done. It's really good for many reasons. One, it does give us a little bit of warning if a bigger Osh object, it makes it possible, once again, to give us a little warning if a bigger object is going to impact a specific area, like the one that hit Russia about a decade ago and caused some damage and a few minor injuries. If they had a 3 hours warning, people could have been warned to not stand near windows and to be prepared for a sonic boom that could do some damage. So this is a good thing, John, and they're learning how to do it now.
Lawfare in space. This is fresh thinking, Bob. The Outer Space Treaty and lawfare. So the claim here is for everything? Everything?
Yes. This is actually from coming out of Africa, which is a very poor continent, mostly because its governments squelch freedom and overregulate for the sake of power. And a lot of the young upper class people from Africa have headed to the United States and Europe to get into the academies and are pushing Marxism and Leninism essentially there. Because Africa itself cannot actually and has not yet learned how to build rockets or satellites, these academics want to use the Outer Space Treaty to regulate. For example, they consider Elon Musk and SpaceX just simply another colonial land grab. That's a quote. And it should be regulated and it should be taken control by others, specifically them. So that they control things instead of others who actually did it. It's pretty shameful.
Regulation, does that mean the United Nations? Is that what they're thinking?
Yes, they basically want to use the Outer Space Treaty to put power into the hands of in the hands of the UN and to basically squelch independent on private enterprise in space. It's basically Marxist-Leninism, and it's pretty shameful that in this day and age that academics, this is where they are. They really don't understand. As I point out, Europe is bad, freedom is bad, and they want to prevent the West civilization from oppressing everyone with freedom and private enterprise. It's pretty sad.
My memory, however, Bob, of the sweep of Star Trek is that invariably when they landed on another planet that had comparable or superior odd technology, it would be ruled by a Supreme Council. And only wise men or wise robots can run the planet. So it's from our reading as young people, Bob, of science fiction. Yeah. This is what the projection is. I don't remember a science fiction novel actually landing on a planet of capitalism. I just don't remember one.
Yeah, the Star Trek started out very much in favor of Western civilization, but the series eventually became a Marxist-Leninist paean to government and command control, no property rights, you won't have any money won't exist, we don't own anything, we all have uniforms and we all work for the government. And there's a ranking system of, officers.
And the Federation makes important decisions. That's what.
Yes, and in fact, if one has watched the entire series of Star Trek to the latest series, by the last season of The Next Generation, the Federation is essentially a fascist state that is trying to destroy a revolutionary group of rebellion, basically a Declaration of Independence, American Revolution in space. And they're trying to shut it down with power and technology. And so that's what a lot of these people have been taught. It's what the academic world now teaches. And unfortunately, they are the future. And so look for the space to be regulated and squelched very badly.
I just mentioned, guys, it's a make-believe story, okay? Fine. So we go now to projections of we're all going to die, the climate models. How are they doing, Bob?
This is another report. This is actually continuing. Nothing has changed, but it's an updated report. You've had Roy Spencer on your show before. He's a climate scientist who actually was the principal investigator for at least one satellite that got data of the temperature data of the Earth over decades. And he's issued a report comparing the actual predictions of 38 different climate models used by the IPCC to predict we're all going to die, and compared that to actual observed data by satellites and ground stations. And what he found is that every single one of those models is wrong and overestimates the amount of warming. And as I note, if these are models, so they're going to be wrong. But if the work was being done properly, you'd have some that would underestimate the heating and some would overestimate the heating. You'd get a kind of mixed randomness around the center. Instead, every single report predicts global warming, some to a ridiculous amount, which indicates there's politics involved and confirmation bias, and it proves once again all these plans are garbage. They also, the discrepancy between data and models has increased over the last 20 years. They had after 10 years, by 2010, it was very clear the models weren't working. They needed to do some work to fix them. They didn't do it, and it's gotten worse. It's really sad.
Bob Zimmerman, Behind the Black, we're going engineering. I'm John.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.